So one of the early scenes that we have, it's kind of crazy. It's like Jordan Peterson barefoot in this indigenous longhouse dancing around a bonfire with these guys with huge wooden masks as he's going through these rituals as he's being kind of accepted into this indigenous family. It's crazy. It's such a 180 from what people read in the headlines.
Zorro is a media platform designed to help you think better, create engaging conversations, and inspire you to live with purpose, aka do dope shit. We host podcasts like the one you're about to listen to, make videos, write articles, and share the work of interesting people. Whether we speak with doctors, designers, athletes, or music artists, we know that this conversation will leave you with a different perspective, and we hope that this conversation inspires you to live a more fulfilling life. If you'd like to keep up with all things Augzoro, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and subscribe to our twice monthly newsletter. In this action-packed email, we send you the latest Augzoro content, as well as articles, podcasts, books, shows, and other content we find exciting and useful. Go to augzoro.com or visit the link in the podcast description to join over 1,000 others who get the newsletter. Also, you can now support Augzoro on Patreon for $2, $5, or $10 per month. On Patreon, you get early access to all podcast episodes, discounts on merchandise, and one Patreon exclusive episode each month. We're an independent platform with no outside investors, and we rely on listeners like you to keep the conversation going. Go to patreon.com/Augzoro to become a patron, and thank you for the support. This time, I sit down with Maziar Gaderi. Maziar Gaderi is a Toronto-based multimedia artist, educator, writer, and director that works with multimedia and interactive technology. In this conversation, we discuss social media bans in Maziar's home country of Iran, the film The Rise of Jordan Peterson, which Maziar produced and his wife directed, Zoroastrianism, The Power of the Eulogy, and more. Without further ado, please enjoy this deep dive with Maziar Gaderi. So what's going on in your home country of Iran right now? We kind of spoke about that over email, and there's obviously a lot going on with the plane being shot down in the news, but from where you are right now, what's going on? What's happening?
I was born in Iran and I was raised mostly in Canada, but I've been staying up to date here on the news and what's happening over there. So basically after the downing of the, after the, you know, the government shot down by accident, they say, the Ukrainian flight that carried mostly Iranians, many Canadians, dual citizens, many students coming back home to Canada from Iran visiting family. Many people on the plane were students coming back home to Canada from visiting family in Iran. So it's pretty tragic, and there's been vigils and memorials that are happening here in Toronto, Edmonton and Vancouver, which many of them are from or based out of or studying out of. Mm-hmm. One of the saddest things is that the government is not allowing any kind of public mourning of their family members. So the family back in Iran, they are not allowed to mourn publicly.
What's the reason for that? Is that kind of like a denial of what's happening?
The reason for that is because they don't want more bad press around it. So they basically go to the family's house and okay. They say, okay, sign these papers. We don't want you to do any media interviews. We definitely don't want you to talk to Western media. And we are even going to, I heard this one story from a trusted journalist that I follow here in Toronto. And she was basically telling me how they are setting up fake mourners to go to the grave sites of these people that died. And by the way, the families aren't being given their bodies until they sign these papers to say you're not going to do any interviews with any media. There's this theatrics around this fake mourning. And this is all done, of course, you know, in a totalitarian government and the kind of government that only really cares about staying in power and could care less about its own citizens. These are very common things to do. I mean, they control the narrative, they control the state media. There isn't really a free press over there. And yeah, so it's quite sad, but I'm happy to know that there are a few journalists here and working underground over there, telling us what's really going down with the aftermath of the flight crash, downing.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's pretty foreign to me. And I would guess most people that are living in the United States to not be able to mourn freely and have someone else being able to, someone else in power telling you what facts you're allowed to say in public or what you're allowed to share with other people. But I guess in a totalitarian regime, like you were saying, that's kind of like their go-to for how they handle things like this.
Yeah, it's all about controlling public perception. But people aren't stupid. I mean, there's been protests in the streets. There's been what's really completely unprecedented is that in these last few months, ever since they hiked up the gas prices in response to the sanctions against Iran, there have been people out in the street publicly calling out the government by name. I mean, these are everyday people, not just the kind of urban liberals in the universities, but when it was the gas prices being hiked up, it was rural folk, you know, conservative religious people that are also calling out the government by name. I've never seen that. It's never been this.
Yeah, that's dangerous for them to do, right? Because they have to worry about getting killed.
Of course, it's 100% dangerous, but I haven't seen it happen also in the countryside. You always kind of see it in the university, maybe more of a liberal, cosmopolitan kind of subgroup, like in the capital in Tehran. You do see that, but it's never been this bad. And the reputation of the government in the eyes of their own people has never been this low. And with that flight being shot down in a completely awful act of incompetence has also helped to kind of have everyday Iranian people once again not trust their own government. So that's a little bit of what's happening on the ground. I really don't know what's going to happen. It's hard to say. I mean, at the end of the day, for most people that are part of the kind of Iranian diaspora, you know, living in the States, Canada, UK, Australia, you know, people that left in the 80s, like my family came as refugees during the Iran-Iraq war, came in 1988. For all of us, you know, it's like this fantasy. We've always had kind of this fantasy of like a free secular Iran, not a utopia, not perfect, but something close to where what you don't want to happen in a country like that, which was the number one export in the 80s, is brain drain. If you have people that are smart enough to get into NASA, that are smart enough to win, you know, prizes and do work in STEM, if these types of people like my parents, decide to leave the country and start all new, and my dad, you know, delivering pizzas for most of his life, if they give all of that up just so their kids are able to live in a freer society, that should tell the mullah something about what they're doing wrong, you know. So that's a main thing: brain drain. When you see brain drain happen in a country, you know that the cultivation of intellectual and artistic, for example, freedoms are being are going against the grains of time, you know.
Hey guys, I wanted to interrupt this episode real quick to let you know that Auxoro also produces a short form podcast called The Aux. The Aux brings you a daily dose of uncensored wisdom to jumpstart your life. 10 minutes or less, no bullshit, no topic off limits. You can subscribe to the show by searching The Aux, A-U-X, wherever you listen to podcasts. For all the latest Auxoro content, you can follow us on Instagram at Auxoro, Twitter at @AuxoroMag, and hit us up for our twice monthly newsletter with the link in the podcast description. Now back to the episode.
I never thought about it like that. The brain drain. It would be like if I spent 8 years or 10 years, maybe even a couple of decades, and I was trying to become a doctor, and then I did, and I got a lot of prestige for it. And then I wanted to live in another society so badly that I just dropped all of that to take a job in the service industry or deliver pizzas like your dad was. And I never really thought about that implication of it, that all the smart people in that country that are leaving to pursue freedoms.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was our number one export in the 80s. Other countries have that too across the Arab world. You'll have that. Philippines is another one. So yeah, so that's the kind of this measure that we try to look at. How well is a country doing for its own people? How well are they able to maintain? It's like recruiting, right? You have a company and you got some of the best coders to build the apps and the games and whatever you need to do. But if they get poached on LinkedIn, it tells you something about you. Well, you weren't able to keep them for these reasons. It kind of happens with Canadian doctors too, right? Like if you're studying medicine, pass your residency or whatever they need to do. Several of them go down into the States, especially in pharmacy, because you can just make more money. So that's a little bit of, because you guys have more of a private sector to your healthcare. So, well, that means that the practitioners get paid a lot more, like so much more. But this element of politically, I mean, brain drain is a completely different level because, I mean, if a person is working in astrophysics and has a dream of, you know, doing that for their own country, they're going to put that aside to have their kids a better future, you know? So and it's an interesting phenomenon to look at. Brain drain is basically this phenomenon that will give a good indication to anybody inside and outside of the country of how well it's doing to offer a good quality of life for its citizens. So as I was saying before, the number one export of Iran in the 80s, especially inclusive of my parents, was brain drain. This idea where its own citizens that are trained, have master's degrees and higher, they look for other opportunities. The intellectuals, basically, they flee the country. They give up their status in that society, usually for the betterment of their kids, to come to a country where they definitely have to take a demotion in terms of the work that they do, but they do that for the sake of, you know, not being under the thumb of a totalitarian government that will totally turn its back on you if it suits them politically.
When people are protesting in the streets against the government, and the government's actively trying to maintain an image and kind of keep things under wraps, especially after the plane crash with an event like that, what control do they have over social media? Did they reprimand people for tweeting things or going on Instagram? Are people even able to do that? What's kind of the government's policy with that?
Yeah, they have to act very quickly, and this is kind of sad. So when there were the protests a few months ago in the streets against the increase in gas prices, there were the clashes got very violent, and then the government shut down the internet for like a week. Just like straight up shut it down.
Across the whole country?
Across the whole country. So
shit.
There's been talk of Iran moving from an internet to an intranet, you know, like just like China. China's done it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to have certain filters to be able to deroute but you got to be able to go to Facebook or Twitter. You have to know what you're doing. Basically, Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff is banned there. I think only Instagram, but I don't know the latest. I haven't been there in several years. But now what's going to happen is going to be even a stronger crackdown on those sorts of freedoms. Funny, we're talking about this because, so my wife and I, so we made the Peterson film.
Yeah.
And we're continuing on with our documentaries, and another concept we're working on is that there's this Lebanese guy that we met, and he was imprisoned in Iran for 4 years. He was invited by the vice president of the country to go to a conference on internet freedoms. Then at the airport, he's intercepted by the Revolutionary Guard. The Revolutionary Guard is kind of like a branch of the government, of the police, of the military, that it's kind of like a secret police, you can say, that works directly with the Ayatollah, that kind of works under the radar. These guys intercepted this guy, Nizar Zaka, that we're developing a documentary, early stages, but we're in talks right now. And they intercepted him, and they put him in prison in the infamous political prison called Evin prison. And he was basically used as a negotiating tactic. So this is part and parcel of what the Iranian regime does. Like, they'll take certain high profile individuals, people, you know, certain Americans that have dual citizenship. And this guy, for example, they'll take them and they'll hold them and they'll get them to confess to nonsense on tape and basically use them as a bargaining chip. And it's been very lucrative for Islamic Republic of Iran. It's been very lucrative. They've been doing this for 40 years. So that's another thing that's happening. So we might be interested to look at that documentary from the freedom of internet angle to see how people can help everyday Iranians get their stories out, get their videos uploaded. Because if people don't know what's happening, it's hard for us to support what they're doing on the streets. So that could be a very interesting angle, but it's something we're developing. But I think it's a worthwhile story to tell because I don't think that many people know about it. And when your freedoms are taken away, they're usually taken away bit by bit, so you don't notice.
Kind of like what Jordan was talking about in the documentary a little bit.
Yeah.
With the freedom of speech.
Yeah, bit by bit. You know, you go an inch by inch every single time. So yeah, it's this topic we wanted to, because I've always felt a little bit, you know, well, I'm just very grateful for my parents able to make those sacrifices and for me to make arts and, you know, do whatever I want basically here in Toronto. I've been very lucky to be able to work in arts and to be in a stable country and be able to have freedom of expression and even to make the Peterson film. You know, we had our troubles, but we could talk about that. But overall, like, nobody really stood in our way, so we're pretty grateful about that. And I've always felt a little bit guilty. I wanted to give something back to the people that kind of were left behind, people that were imprisoned for something that I would do, like walking, you know, there's these two tourists who couldn't get a hotel and went to sleep in their car, but they did it next to a military base and they had no idea and they were imprisoned for that for years.
Yeah, and they were just, where was this at?
This was in Iran. I don't know exactly where.
Oh, yeah. And they were just sleeping in their car and they got locked up for years for that.
Just sleeping. So
that's crazy. I've done that when I used to play baseball. If we had long drives, I would just pull over on the side of the road and knock off for 3 hours. And then if someone, I couldn't imagine someone just knocking on my window and taking me to prison because I was next to a military base that I didn't even know was there.
Yeah, so it's a completely different world, but I like to remind myself of how bad it can get and kind of use my privilege over here in the West, being an Anglophone, you know, having good internet, just the little things we take for granted to kind of help to tell the stories of these guys, because doing it in a way that doesn't create apathy, doing it in a way that has people be informed about what's happening and then inch by inch, seeing how we can support these people that are, you know, they don't even have their own government to protect them. Their own government uses them.
Are there kind of like these rogue people on the ground in Iran that are trying to keep people, like the average citizen, connected to things like Facebook or Twitter, or just to have an internet connection in general? There are people that kind of are working on a backdoor to get past the sanctions that the government has in place.
Yeah, there are people. There's everyday people, people with computer backgrounds that find ways to get around certain sensors and filters that is put on the sites and the IP addresses. So there is that. So information does get leaked out, and that's a good thing. But the internet's very, very slow. So to upload a video, a cell phone video, does take a long time. When I was there, that was in 2010 now. But when I was there, the internet's super slow. But, you know, social media is helpful and people sharing photos and text quickly and being able to do it in a way. Obviously, all the accounts are anonymous, so that's really useful for safety. So there are people that are doing their thing. I mean, humans will always try to find a way to make it happen. And Iranians are no different.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about the anonymity of Twitter accounts, and most of the rhetoric in the US is that people don't really like it because it gives people something to hide behind and they're not really accountable for what they say on Twitter, that you can basically put anything out there and there's nothing that's really tied to you. But I guess something that I didn't really think about is the opposite side of that, where you have people that to protect themselves and their families, they can't have their faces on an avatar or they can't have any personal information about them because they're going to get locked up. And yeah, I guess there's kind of an equal and opposite reaction with everything that you do on social media. It could be good for in one sense where we do have the freedoms to say things like that, but then for people that can't afford to do that, it would completely screw them over.
It's this two-sided coin that, like, on one hand, it's like, yeah, like when we came out with the film and there was a lot of chatter, there were these anonymous accounts on both sides of the aisle. Some people thought, oh, you're making a you're the guys that made the Jordan Peterson film. It's obviously a hit piece and you're trying to make them look bad. These little green frog people, right? Little Keck guys. And they were talking their shit and they were able to do it, you know, cloaked. And then on the other side, you have the social justice warriors doing the same thing to us, talking about, you know, you're making films about bigots and all these things. So it's very annoying, right? And because we're out there, it's our real faces, but they're not meeting us equally on that level. And then I kind of felt the same way. I was like, no, let's have everybody, let's make it that you have to be the actual person you say you are. But then, of course, on the other side, which is, you know, literally the other side of the world that we don't actually have to deal with, it's like the government is just like you're on there tweeting pictures of whatever. The government's on there too, and they have their little spies, and they have their little bots, and they have their algorithms to find certain keywords and isolate certain people. And then if they find them in real life, the consequences are awful because, you know, just being associated with certain content can get you locked up. So yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky. And it's also another thing that's tricky. It's kind of like this, the gift and the curse kind of is the sanctions that were put on Iran has made it a lot harder for the people of the country to see their government as kind of protecting them, because the sanctions have been so bad that the prices of like everyday goods are so high that it's even affecting the upper middle class. Like they're very aggressive. They haven't been this strong ever. But I kind of don't mind that because it creates a separation between the people and the government. But at the same time, the sanctions have also made it harder for everyday Iranians to have access to anti-censorship software, for example. So if they want to get a piece of software that helps them evade the government blockades of the sites they want to visit, it's harder to do that because of the sanctions. So if the sanctions could be a bit smarter, where we're trying to help people have free access to information, then that's a good thing. But if they're these blanket sanctions, and they have been, that affect every aspect of anything where everyday Iranian guy wants to purchase something, it makes it almost impossible for him to do so. You know, companies aren't allowed to work with Iranian business people, everyday people, non-governmental, because of the sanctions.
And if it's starting to leak over into the middle upper class, and those people have more money and more power, hopefully they'll be able to get behind it and do something about it. It kind of like in the US, there are a lot of issues that I feel like stay underground because it's only affecting people that don't have a lot of money. And then as soon as that starts to leak over into the middle class, then there's more of an uproar and people start caring about it because it's affecting them.
Yep, 100%. Yep.
To get into the rise of Jordan Peterson a little bit, I want to say I love the documentary that you and your wife made, and I've been following Jordan Peterson for about 18 months, I would say. I first saw him on the Joe Rogan podcast, and then I started going through some of his lectures online, and I've listened to conversations between him and Sam Harris and some other people that are in the intellectual dark web. And one of the things that I kind of hung on to, or one of the many things that that stuck out from the film, is the human side of Jordan Peterson. Just some of the clips where he was sipping coffee and just looking at his face, or watching him eat breakfast in the morning, or like a discussion between him and his wife where clearly he's on edge, and kind of like these human moments that you don't always get to see when he's in Jordan Peterson mode, when he's on a podcast, or when he's giving a lecture. For you, what was it about Jordan Peterson that made you want to make this documentary in the first place and kind of add that human element?
When I first met him in 2015, so my then girlfriend, now wife, she was always a reader of his work. She studied psychology in her undergrad and was there in the Maps of Meaning days, which was his first book. Very mm-hmm. dense book, very kind of deep existential book, very different from 12 Rules for Life. So she was following his work since back then. And then I had met him because we had lived in the same neighborhood, and she went to a class of his, asked him, hey, you know, would you be interested in us doing some filming together? I think there's a story here. I've been a fan of your work, et cetera. And then we went over to their place and met the wife, Tammy. And I knew right away that he's kind of a peculiar guy, kind of an eccentric, different kind of person. He has an authenticity to him, and a deep thinker. And back in the day, you know, back then there was, you know, YouTube videos, really poor quality. Mm-hmm. They're still up there of his stuff. Like when he would film himself with like a webcam, and it'd be like 1200 views. Yeah. But I checked it out, and it was interesting, you know, him talking about his interpretation of like Pinocchio or Lion King. And he was always a popular professor. Like he'd be the kind of prof where students would line up after class to talk to him. So he was seen as kind of like a life-changing professor. He was always well-known in Harvard. And then when he came to the University of Toronto in the psychology department, his classes were always full. So he was always that kind of prof, but he lived in that kind of academic, kind of psychology, kind of nerd world, you know, and it didn't really go past that. So yeah, so we knew right away that there was something interesting here. And then, you know, fast forward, like almost 2 years later, after we got to know them pretty well and got to know the family and did a lot of behind, like very kind of like cinema vérité shots where we're just hanging out mm-hmm. and they're just eating or doing a personality test or just whatever they were doing. Not really staged, not really a talking head sort of style, but just kind of like in the background. And we just mic'd them up and we just filmed to the SD card was full, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the Professor Against Political Correctness video came out in October 2016, and then everything changed. He was in the news like every day for like 6-7 months. And then there was like a scandal every week. You had Kathy Newman over here. You had the debates with Sam Harris, and you had the Joe Rogan. He was on there 3 times. It was like millions and millions of hits. And, you know, we were like, okay, we have to keep the camera mm-hmm. on. And what most people don't know is that for those first kind of, that first year and a half, we were actually interested. We were following a completely different story. I mean, the story that we were doing was about his friendship with an indigenous carver from Vancouver Island that he would buy art from that he met at a hippie fair like 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was just this interesting friendship because these two guys are so different. So like a week and a half after Patricia, the director of the film, my wife, she met Jordan. She flew to Vancouver to go shoot the carving of a totem pole that was being made by Charles Joseph, Jordan's friend and now actually brother. So Jordan and his family were being adopted into Charles Joseph's family. So one of the early scenes that we have, it's kind of crazy. It's like Jordan Peterson barefoot in this indigenous longhouse mm-hmm. dancing around a bonfire with these guys with huge wooden masks as he's going through these rituals as he's being kind of accepted into this indigenous family. It's crazy. It's such a 180 from what people hear read in the headlines.
The political correctness video that he put out kind of shifted the narrative. and you decided to go in that direction.
We had to. I mean, we couldn't not talk about that. And at the same time, we didn't want to give up the original concept that we wanted to do, which we're now working on again. Now that the Rise film is done, we're going to go back and do the original film, because the footage we have is ridiculous. It's so crazy. Like, he's, you know, it's really going to blow people away. It's going to be not what people expect at all, because it all happened before he was super famous and before the politics and then the media changed or morphed or sculpted him into something else. This is all before that. And so, yeah, so it was, so the film, the way we wanted to approach The Rise of Jordan Peterson was that we wanted it to be a human film. We wanted it. We knew that the debates and the lectures and the ideas, all that stuff is online anyway. We wanted to do something that isn't out there yet. And that was also the same thing that we, was a strength of ours. It was the intimate in-between moments. So that's why we made the film the way we did.
One of those in-between moments that I thought was really powerful and I identify with as a podcaster is when he was talking to the camera and he was saying something, then he messed it up and went back to say it again. And you could see like the kind of stress on his face. I don't know if he was 45 minutes into recording or he had just started, but when he messed up, I was like, that kind of hit home with the point that not all content is perfect. The final version that you see out there when someone puts out a lecture or, you know, releases a song or puts out a book, there's a lot of slip-ups along the way. And when he paused for a second and kind of went back a couple times to say it more how he wanted to say it, I really felt the connection behind that.
Yeah, I remember that clip. That was in response to some of the alt-right accusations. It was like in the week of Charlottesville when that girl got killed. So that was a crazy time. Yeah, it was stressful for him and for a lot of people. And us too, because it was there was just so much of the story that we had to cut. Because at the end of the day, if it doesn't serve the main arc of the story, you got to cut it. Because every week there was a new scandal. It was hard to figure out. And we were editing it as we were shooting it. Like, this wasn't something that was kind of pre-written. You know, those types of documentaries are a lot easier to do. You basically write it out, get a story editor, sculpt it out, act one, act two, act three, and then go shoot what you need to shoot. And it's a lot more cost effective. It's a lot easier on your head. But this film, I mean, it took us like 4 years to do it. There were so many shoots and so much footage that we're going to be making mini docs out of. And we have just so much content that we're going to release for digital sale. And, but it was hard to, it was kind of very emergent. The story was being written as we were editing it, as we were shooting it. But thankfully, we're able to sell it to a distributor. And when you do that, you got to have a deadline. They say, okay, guys, we need a picture lock. We need a fine cut by this date. And that was good because it gave us a deadline, something to work with. And then by that date, we're like, okay, by this date, we have to stop shooting and we just hit the editing.
I think it captured the sort of the weirdness of fame pretty well, especially since he's a guy that spent the first almost 50 years of his life that was a rock star in the classroom and amongst his peers. And then all of a sudden, he's saying things to thousands of people every night. And then he puts out a YouTube video and 10 million people watch it. And it has to be weird. Like, that's the only word I can think of right now to describe it. But to live for that long and then become super famous at such a late stage in your life, not at such a late stage, but he's in the middle of his life. And to kind of compare that with the way things are now for the younger generation and my generation, I'm 26 years old. So there are a lot of people that are around my age that are kind of obsessed with the idea of fame. And they think that their life will be better the more people that know that they exist and they want to be famous on Instagram or YouTube and kind of get all this stuff out there. And then you have Jordan Peterson, who was happy doing the work that he was doing. And then it sounds like kind of unknowingly opened the door to this other world of fame that he was never a part of before?
Yeah, he was always interested in building his YouTube channel. He was always interested in kind of spreading his reach outside of the classroom with YouTube specifically and Twitter. So he always had those aspirations. And do you remember that scene about the funeral there of Bobby Kennedy? Remember that?
Yeah. He said that, that's right. He said he wanted to have a funeral like Bobby Kennedy. He said that was his first political memory.
Yeah. So that scene is very interesting, the way people would react to it, because it says more about the person that's reacting to it than it does Jordan. Because on one hand, some people would say, oh, look at this guy. He's so full of himself. When he was a kid, he thought he would have a big funeral like that, total narcissist. And on the other hand, some people would say, well, isn't that very interesting for a young boy to think that? And then also look what he's become. Like, he has been a life-changing person for so many people. He has been this person that people, like when we were doing this tour across the States, in Brooklyn too, we did two screenings. Well, one got canceled, but that's another story. You know, people would come up to us and they just wanted to be near us because we were near to that guy that, you know, changed their life for the better. So they were they wanted to hear all the stories. They wanted to take us for beers after the screenings, you know. So that scene with the Bobby Kennedy and Jordan's kind of vision of having a funeral like that is interesting because it's one of those choice scenes that says a lot about how people, it's the way somebody reacts to it says a lot about them and what they think about Jordan and how distrustful they are or how grateful they are for him, or maybe somewhere down the middle. It definitely is a peculiar thought for, I think he might've been 5 at the time when that happened. But yeah, to your point of, yeah, like Jordan got super famous super quickly. And I think part of the reason, I would say the main reason it's been able to turn into kind of more of a longstanding kind of people being attentive to him rather than just kind of like a scandal that goes away is because his book was so well written and so well received commercially. Like, it did well. It's probably the most well-sold book by a Canadian writer. I think it sold more than 3 million copies. It sold 250,000 in Korea. Like, it's translated into 50 languages. And it's a very kind of like, you know, like not too heady and hard to get through, like Maps of Meaning. And it has a pop feel to it. Like, people can dive in. It's 12 rules. You pick a rule, you know, those that's really in right now, right? With like the kind of mainstream bookshelves. So it's very accessible for people, but it still gives you that Jordan-esque quality to it. So I think the book really helped to keep him around and to continue the conversation. And the tours that he's been doing for the book, those videos are really, really show some of his best work, I think. And another thing that's been helped to make him kind of interesting for people is the biblical lectures he did in Toronto. That's probably one of the most popular things he's done on his YouTube channel. He basically breaks down a fable or a chapter or a character from the Bible and breaks it down from his perspective, from a philosophical perspective. So that's been really popular as well. So he's had these different buckets where he's explored his interests and people have responded.
Yeah. And going back to the Bobby Kennedy scene, the way that I saw that, I didn't think that it was coming from like an inflated view of himself or anything like that, especially since he had those thoughts when he was a kid. But it made me think of, and I'm sure a lot of people have this fear too, but not having anyone show up to your funeral, kind of the exact opposite of what happened to Bobby Kennedy. I think a lot of people would say that one of their worst fears would be if they died and, you know, they had 3 people there who kind of gave a shit about them and they lived their life in a way that didn't really connect with as many people as they could have. So when I saw that, the Bobby Kennedy scene, it made me think of wanting to live my life in a way where people would want to show up or hopefully when I'm gone, people would feel some sort of connection for me.
What you're saying reminds me of something I read do we live our actions by filling out a resume or filling out a great eulogy? I try to remember that one. Like if I'm doing something or I'm making a decision, is this better more for my short term, like on the CV, on the resume? Or is it something that can transcend all of that and be relevant in a eulogy for me? You know, I think that's an interesting way to approach life.
Yeah, eulogy versus resume. Yeah, that is a cool way to look at it. I've never thought about that before. Like if you're gonna do something, is it to look good for, you know, the next promotion in life, or is it something that's gonna connect with people on a deeper level? So like something that's more timeless, whether you did it now or 20 years from now, it'll still apply.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a good little benchmark to think about. You know, when we have all these choices we have to make in life.
Yeah, because no one's gonna read your resume at your funeral. Who gives a shit?
No kidding. That'd be a funny funeral, actually. CVs.
I was thinking about that the other day when I think I was talking to my friend Doug, but basically if you could plan your funeral before it happened, if you're still alive and you planned out your funeral, I don't think anyone would choose how their funeral actually ends up. Like having it in a church with people crying and like very sad, everyone wearing black. If I were to write my funeral today at 26 years old, I would want everyone, you know, taking shots of tequila, have like a music artist playing, you know, having a good time, maybe read some funny material, make some jokes and things like that.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
So there was another person in the film, was Lane. Is that
Lane,
the
yeah.
name? Lane, the trans activist?
Yeah, Lane.
I like how you also included perspectives like Lane's, the people that didn't agree with his main points. And I saw in another interview, I think it was with Chloe Valderi, you mentioned that the first yeah. time that Lane had ever heard words come out of Jordan Peterson's mouth was when Lane saw the documentary. And I thought that was pretty powerful, because that meant that Lane was just going off of other people's ideas of Jordan Peterson and not actually going by what Jordan Peterson was saying. Like Lane didn't actually listen to a 2-hour podcast of Jordan Peterson or watch one of his lectures on YouTube. It was from, I imagine, a headline or some article about him that maybe wasn't representing his views correctly.
Yeah. Lane had said that when they came over to watch the doc at our place, because usually what you do with the main characters, or at least people you want to have a good dialogue with, is after the film is locked, like the editing is done, usually show the film to them. And yeah, that's one of the first things Lane said. I thought that was interesting to hear. And I think that it was useful for Lane to kind of hear what Jordan had to say in full. And then they said, do you think Jordan would have a beer with me? So this was really interesting for so many reasons, because what happens a lot of the time, and this happens to all of us, but it can happen more if you're younger. Lane at the time, I think, was 22 and coming from, you know, a bit of trouble with identity and figuring things out, attempted suicide a few times when they were younger. So when you're in that headspace, and we've all been there a little bit, what happens is that we tend to create catastrophes of people that we think are our enemies that live in the same city or down the street. And we kind of create this monster. For people that see Jordan a certain way, Jordan Peterson ends up being this 8-foot monster who, when he talks, like shoots out swastikas like ninja stars, you know, like
he's like some Nazi ninja.
Yeah, like he's like, he'll, if he breathes on you, you'll get, you know, you'll die. Or like it's really this catastrophizing that is actually not, it's really, really bad for people that have anxiety already, because you create a world of binaries of good and evil. And you really, really love the people that accept you, and you defend them to death, but you don't go outside of that bubble. And then the people that you think are your enemies, which Lane thought of Jordan, and it makes them larger than life. It gives them more power than they actually have. So I think it could have been, you could say maybe it was a bit of a therapeutic, I hope, I haven't talked to Lane in a while, but to see the film with us and to kind of demystify and deflate what this guy was saying and what he wasn't saying, I think is very useful for people to hear. And the opposite is true too. Like, just so many people that I met, a lot of the people that hosted our film were conservatives, Christians, and libertarian types. Like, we did 5 screenings in Texas. And a lot of these guys are like terrified of communism and socialism, and you should be more scared of communism, I guess. But I don't think any of them have actually even read Marx, you know? So there is this catastrophizing that happens of the SJW, of, oh, you know, they're going to, some of the things that they say, you know, it's like, they'll talk about, oh, they're going to turn my kids gay, or they're going to, Sharia law is coming to Cleveland this Memorial Day weekend. You know, like, it happens with them too. And unfortunately, the way that most of us talk to each other, like the way you found out about me, I think probably the way you found out about the film, the way maybe I've heard about this podcast, is all through social technology. It's all through social media. And the problem with that is, and it's our own fault, those types of technologies, they encourage reactions that are the more emotional, because that there's a kind of a marriage now between the market, you know, money, bottom line, capitalism, and content creation, news, infotainment, kind of celebrity takes, you know, that kind of thing, TMZ.
Oh yeah, like the bite-sized clips of everything, rather bite-sized, which is why clips, I love podcasts, because you can only show off the bite-sized clip version of yourself for 5 or 10 minutes. And then if you're going to sit across from someone for an hour and a half, you can't have your bullshit deflector up the entire time. Eventually you're going to have to get real with someone.
Yeah. It gives a better picture of people. But for the most part, people share articles that they haven't read and just, they like the headline. Right. So that creates a more of a us and them world. You can't have a good guy, or, you know, you go on Facebook, you want to share a certain thing. Well, I want to be a good guy. You can't be a good guy if there isn't a bad guy. So I think that's part of the problem that creates these catastrophes in our own head about what we think our neighbor might be like, or what they're doing behind closed doors, you know?
And the conversation element kind of breaks that down. Like what you were saying, the catastrophizing gives Jordan Peterson more power than he has, and you don't feel bad catastrophizing him, because you may not see him as a human. You may see him as the guy in the mask, like when you had that scene in the film where you had him put on the mask at the beginning and at the end. If you see him as sort of this caricature of his most headlined beliefs, then you may not see him as just a guy who's out there trying to fulfill his purpose. But then if you have conversations, like when Lane was sitting down and watching the documentary and said that they wanted to have a beer with him after, I think that's great. When I'm watching the Democratic debates, as much of a political theater as it could be, I think about which candidate would I rather have a beer with, like who would actually be real if I sit down and want to talk to them. So I think that's part of what breaks down the catastrophizing.
Yeah, I agree. Fully.
I think the first time I heard of the film was when it was, I think it was supposed to show somewhere in Brooklyn, and it ended up not happening. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it was at, it's called Shapeshifter Lab. Mm-hmm. It's a little music venue place that we can afford. Brooklyn's so expensive.
I was going to say, I'm lucky I have some affordable rent in Brooklyn, because there's some places that are pretty swanky. They shop at Whole Foods.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was October 6th. So we did our US premiere at Shapeshifter Lab. So the first screening happened, sold out pretty quickly. Then what happened is that we already had an encore set up for the Sunday, just a few days after, because it sold out so quick. And then it was the encore that got canceled the night before, via email by the owners. Now, they were citing safety concerns. They were basically talking about how the staff felt unsafe to be there because of the content in the film, and they weren't going to show up to work. So what was really unfortunate about that, there were so many things, but one of the things were that the owners of the Shapeshifter Lab, we had sent them the film back in August when we were having conversations about finding venues. We wanted them to know what the film was, right? That's only fair. They never watched it. They never even clicked on the link. And the night before, now they suddenly have an issue with the film. And it was a shame that we weren't able to have a conversation with some of the staff. There were these young guys, you know, like could have been 20, 21, hipster types.
So there was no phone call or anything? It was just an email?
No, it was just an email. And it's a shame that we weren't able to have a conversation with them, the people that were offended and felt unsafe. I really would like to hear from them directly about how they felt that way. But it was a shame. And that happened. We had another cancellation in Toronto. This one was really unique. Like, there's a cinema called the Grand Girard. It's like a kind of an art house cinema in Leslieville, which is kind of like a hipster-ish kind of neighborhood. And they wanted to, through somebody I met, we arranged, can we pick a date? We'd like to, we'll split the box office. And the guy we knew there was down. Then he had spoken with the committee and he said, well, we'd like to have a post-film discussion with trans activists and you guys talk about the film. And we said, okay, that sounds like a great idea. Let's have a dialogue. We haven't been able to get trans people, progressive people, for the majority of our tour, entirely almost, to come out and to talk with us. So these guys were going to arrange it because that's more their background. It's more their crew, their network. We thought it's a great idea. But then we thought it probably would be fair if we actually have more kind of Jordan Peterson fans or followers of his work to join us as well. Because Patricia and I, we didn't want to frame ourselves as kind of like defending Jordan's views because we don't agree with a lot of them. We're the filmmakers. We're the platform. We can talk about the film, but if a trans activist wants to make an argument about Jordan, what he said or what he didn't say, I don't want to be put in a position where I have to defend Jordan.
Yeah.
Or criticize him. That's not really, let the film speak for itself. We'll talk about the film, choices that we made. That's different. So we said, okay, let's have a third party here where they can be that side of the argument, where they wholly believe in Jordan's take of the pronoun law and all that. Then they got back to us and said that because of that reason, they felt unsafe to be in the same room with Jordan Peterson followers. And we thought that was ridiculous. And the people that we met on tour, like these aren't inflammatory kind of like Milo Bannon. That's kind of what they see it as. And that's part of the catastrophizing. They don't see the difference between somebody like Jordan Peterson or like a Sam Harris and somebody like Steve Bannon.
Yeah, they kind of all get lumped together into the same group.
Yeah, because they're so far on this side and that stuff, they feel it threatens them so much that they can't even be in a situation where they're in dialogue with them. And I think that's a shame. Partly because the screening didn't happen, but partly because I think the dialogue would have been really good. And I think it would have been really challenging. And if it's the kind of people that came out to our screening that were very thoughtful people, like they weren't these Jordanian drones, you know, that just spew whatever Jordan says. Like they were thoughtful. They were like, well, I think Jordan's a bit off here. And your doc was interesting because it made me question a little things that I didn't know about in between. And like they're really engaging with the content completely from a nonpartisan point of view. Like many were liberals actually. They just have some grievances with progressive culture that Jordan brought up. But some of them were just curious and like to hear people share their ideas and like to hear people that are honest, like Jordan is. That was really disappointing, where the situation could have been a really good footing for a conversation, but even that didn't work for them. So,
yeah, that could have been a great time to have trans activists and people that were more in the bandwagon, not the bandwagon of Jordan Peterson, but just shared a lot of his values and views to kind of go back and forth with each other in an environment that was set up to do that. But the whole danger thing and people being afraid of speech, I'm reading this book called The Coddling of the American Mind, and it goes into a lot of how people are conflating danger with discomfort and discomfort with danger, especially on college campuses. And it made me think of that because you have one side where you may be just saying provocative things for the sake of being provocative. You don't actually have an argument and you're just saying it to kind of piss people off. And then you have the other side where, you know, people say, you know, you're hurting me with your views, or your views are actually putting me in danger. And the only way I see to get out of that is to have more conversations. But if you're in an environment like a college campus that is actively perpetuating the denial of certain views based on your level of comfort, then I don't see how that's supposed to help you navigate society and defend your views and have open conversations with people you disagree with. I think one of the most fun things is to have conversations with people that you disagree with on some things, whether it's on a podcast or maybe you're going out for a date, or it's just like a stranger that you run into on a street, like having a deep intellectual conversation and then walking away, understanding someone a little bit more. Even if you don't really agree with everything they said, at least you understand that person. And the situation with the trans activists and the Jordan Peterson activists or Jordan Peterson followers kind of, I guess, hits a similar nerve with the danger versus discomfort. Are you actually hurting me with your speech? Is your speech actually dangerous? Or are you just in an environment that's kind of putting you through this cycle of reaffirming your belief of danger, so you never actually like get over that belief?
I've been thinking about this a while, and the best way for me to understand them would be like this. Do you remember the part in the film where Jordan says, "I don't recognize somebody's right to determine what pronouns I use to address them. I won't do it." Mm-hmm. It was like at the beginning, it's in the PC video. That mm-hmm. sentence right there for a 20-year-old person who is struggling with gender dysphoria, is a little bit, am I gay? Am I straight? Am I non-binary? There's a distance between them and their parents, for example. Puberty was difficult to go through. Anxiety, put that on top of teenage angst, which we all have all had. Mm-hmm. Body image, all these things. For that person to hear somebody say that in a film, it's going to challenge their identity or their thinking and their apparatus that they're using to feel more whole. It challenges them in a way that they might not be ready for. So that's the thing. It's for them, it's not just let's have a debate and marketplace of ideas and all that. For them, it goes right into the core of their of who they are, mm-hmm. you know, like their identity as, and they're still working it out, and they're very young. And it's not just young people. There's people that are older in their 40s and 50s that are now claiming non-binary, like I'm a non-binary person now. They're growing into that, and that's part of their thing. And these are people that there's an instability with their identity that they're trying to figure out in real time. But there is the good news is that at the end of this month, we are flying over to Salt Spring Island off the coast of Vancouver. This is a super lefty, super progressive, super hippie kind of part of Canada. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be doing a screening there at the Salt Spring Film Festival. And we're really happy for them to host us because they're probably the only like art house film festival progressive type that are willing to screen the film. And it's a bit easier for them to do that now. We already had our run and everything. So I think that's really cool nevertheless. And we're going to be doing this little this little event, a 3-hour event. It's going to be called State of the Arts, where Patricia and I are going to be on a panel with other writers and curators and different artists. And we're basically going to talk about these issues and really kind of steel man these arguments. So what we did at Columbia University there in Manhattan, we were there in November. We did a thing where we basically steel manned the arguments that we heard from people on the other side of the political aisle that said, you shouldn't screen this film here for these reasons. We took their very, very best arguments and we kind of interrogated them and broke them apart and thought about, okay, well, how do we respond to that? We want to do that same thing over again, but with artists and the type of people that would come out that live on that island are very progressive type of people. And we want to kind of have this dialogue with them. I don't like this idea. There's this boredom that kind of gets sparked in me when I'm talking about SJWs without them being there. You know, it's like this, I'm talking about progressivism without progressives. It's like we already agree. We're preaching to the choir. We already agree that stuff is a bit silly. So what's the point of even talking about it? But what I'm trying to do here with the State of the Arts is do it with creators. You know, hot button things that are huge in arts, you know, cultural appropriation, who gets to tell which stories, Me Too, quotas, equity, gender pay gap. There's so many of these issues. And we want to kind of, after we do our little spiel, we want to break the group up into little groups. And we want to create little case studies, fictionalized of kind of situations, problems that are based on something that actually happened. Give it to them, give it to one group, and basically say, okay, in about 40 minutes, tell me how you would address this. And I think it'll be a really cool experiment to see how that goes down, because it's going to be a lot of people that know each other, but because it's going to be these case studies that are fictionalized, making it fictionalized makes it a little bit easier, I think, for people to be more honest about how they feel. And I want to just kind of lay it out, and we want to record it, record the audio for a podcast, to be able to disseminate it. So that's something that we kind of have been thinking about on tour. You know, what's missing here? And what's missing is that we haven't really been able to have cross-partisan, you know, cross-political aisle, social aisle with people that wouldn't typically come to see a Jordan Peterson film, but might go see it because they respect the festival. You know, it's a small crew. It's a small island. So that's something that we're excited about. We're going to be doing at the end of the month.
Yeah, I like that idea, having people kind of parse out these issues. Even if they are fictional, there's still a lot of value in going through some of the arguments that are based in real life things that are happening right now. One of the perspectives I was thinking about during the film was the perspective of a transgender kid, maybe someone who's 18 to 21 in college. And while I do believe that college should be an open sphere for debate and free speech, and I take the view that speech is not violence, and the speech that is violence is made illegal under the First Amendment. So as long as you're not directly calling for someone's harm or saying, you know, kill this person, I think that there should be an open form of debate to kind of work through discomfort. And then with that being said, I can't imagine what it's like to be someone who's a teenager, you know, hormones pumping through your body, kind of not sure what you're going to do in life. And on top of that, you also have this gender identity crisis where you don't really fit into the category of most of your peers. You have this whole other set of issues that you have to work through yourself. So I can definitely see that perspective, using someone who's transgender, for example, as being in a situation where they can perceive that speech as an attack against their identity. And that's why I think that conversation, like what you guys are doing, is great, because there's a nuance there. You can think that you can fight for free speech, but at the same time, you can also be sensitive to other people's perspective.
Yeah, it's a thin line. It gets hard to do when you throw identity, and a lot of things, if you break it down, it has to do with identity. Somebody's religion, somebody's ethnicity, somebody's you know, somebody has an accent. Like a lot of it has to do with people's identities, the most heated things, because it stops being abstract and it starts to become personal. And that's when conversations get very messy, if they even happen at all. So,
yeah, I guess for topics like religion and sexuality, gender, the things that are personal, it's so much harder to talk about because you feel so closely attached to it. It's not like you're arguing your favorite book or your favorite movie or, you know, a podcast you listened to last week. When those issues kind of cross over into how you see yourself, I'm sure it gets a lot tougher to accept the nuance or listen to other people's opinions.
Yeah.
Even though I still think it's really important to do that, I can see the difficulty in it.
Yeah. Speaking of religion, did you get a chance to check out Messiah?
Yes. Yeah, I did. Watched. I had time to watch the first three episodes, and I liked what I saw so far. It was an interesting take on why not just people believing, but kind of how a belief starts to form from scratch. What was your take on the series?
Yeah, wait till you get to the cliffhanger
at the end of the
season. It gets really good. Yeah, I thought it was an interesting thing where you're looking, because I didn't grow up with religion at all. And I thought it was really interesting to have this guy kind of come out of nowhere, leads people in the desert, tries to go into Israel, gets there, gets questioned, and then et cetera, et cetera. The story goes on and on. And the way different people would react to what would happen if there was a Messiah type person that comes into like in current affairs, like literally this guy thinks he's a Messiah. How many people are skeptical? How many people believe him? And what does that mean in the sense of belief? How does that change their politics or the way they look about it? And everybody tries to make him a piece of himself. And the more fundamental ones actually can be threatened by it, because the people that mix up religion, and you saw that with, I don't know if you can see this part yet, but I'll say it in generally, the people that are using religion for political power mm-hmm. are actually threatened by somebody like that, because he's actually not advocating for anything in specific. He's just talking about unity. He's talking like the true message of like how what religion should be. So certain people are threatened by it and actually want to cause somebody like that harm. Certain other people flock to him. Certain people want to follow him. They want him to think for them. Certain people are inspired by him. Certain people want to, some people hate him. They think he's a bullshitter. They think he's, and that's another thing that's really cool about the film or the series. I love this idea of, the film Rise is kind of like this. Mm-hmm. The Peterson film is kind of like, we're never really trying to tell you what to think of the guy, and Messiah does that really well. Is he a Messiah or is he a charlatan? You know, and the way that actor in Messiah has certain kind of facial expressions where he kind of like sunks in his cheeks a little bit and has this mm-hmm. little smile. It's a little bit like a charlatan. So he's kind of balancing it out just to kind of throw that curveball, the way he's portraying that character. I thought that was really interesting because, and then, you know, usually when a story is framed like that or like in Rise, it's like the question might be a little bit of both, right? Like a little bit of, or does it matter? Does it matter? Does it matter if Jesus actually existed? Like, is it more about what you put on him or what he symbolizes? Like some accounts say that Jesus was never actually a person. So I think it brings up all these questions that are useful. And religion isn't something that, it's just not cool, right? Like religion is just not, in the 90s, and it's always been kind of like Ned Flanders, you know? It's like, oh, you go to church, you know? Like, you know, it's never been something, like in an urban setting, is something that's been... People kind of hide it a little bit. And I think that this is talking about religious ideas in a very cool way. And it's pretty dramatic. So I've been enjoying the series. I can't wait for season two to come out.
Yeah, it kind of made me think about my own progression with religion, because I was raised Catholic. And then I started getting into more atheist books and readings and kind of exploring atheism for, you know, what it is. Like, do we need something to believe in? Kind of unpacking a lot of things that I was told to believe in and a lot of the mindsets that I adopted when I was a kid, and some things that I always really had a problem with, but then things that kind of came to the surface once I started exploring atheism. But then it also made me think when I was watching Messiah, even if there is no God, and if it's, say, Jesus wasn't a person, or say Jesus was just like a normal dude that people kind of ascribed these Messiah-like characteristics to, would that be for the good of mankind, or do we need someone to believe in? Like, is there a practicality to widespread atheism, or is all of the shitty things that happen because of religion, is that balanced out by our believing in something greater? It kind of made me think about that.
Yeah. I think religion has a useful quality for community building and for social cohesion, to be part of something, you know, like it's kind of like an extended family, kind of like the idea where if you go and do something once per week, and this could be a lot of different things. It could be centered around a hobby, but you need that something to feel part of a community. And, you know, meetup.com, I mean, that's what that whole model is about. Facebook events and things like that. So religion just takes it much deeper. But I think for some people that are religious and, you know, we're a cross or whatever, some of them aren't that interested in the dogma. They want to be part of something once per week, and they meet like-minded people there, and they feel like they want to be part of something. So it's like religion means so many different things for different people. Like extremism, for example, like jihad. Like somebody can be religious and very kind of like, you know, literal, but not take it to the extent of like a physical manifestation, like in the city that they live in.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody could be like a nutbag, you know, like a crazy person who doesn't have any empathy and maybe was abused as a kid or feels I got nothing to lose. And they'll take on religion as a way to fulfill that. Like it's a weird, a really good, I love, you should check out if you haven't, Sam Harris had a great conversation with, what was that guy's name? Lawrence. He's the guy that wrote The Siege and The Looming Tower. He's one of the guys who has spoken a lot about Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
Lawrence Wright. That's it.
I'll check that out.
I love the way he talked about it. Yeah. He talks about it in a very interesting way. He talks about it, about how, because Sam kind of simplifies things a little bit with religion because he's coming from an atheistic background. So he doesn't think much about that stuff to begin with. But Lawrence, who's lived in Egypt and has taught English in Saudi Arabia, I think it's where he taught. I mean, his way of talking about it is so much more nuanced and accurate. But yeah, religion is the need for it. And this is something that I would relate to with Jordan, is that when we were filming the Bible lectures, I thought, well, this is going to be boring. You know, I don't want to hear about the Bible. This is just, you know, that was my first reaction. And then I'm sitting there behind the camera listening to what the guy has to say. And it was interesting because from a kind of artistic story lover, kind of a guy who likes mythology or kind of meta themes, and I'm always looking for different things to build into my own writing, there's definitely some interesting things there. I liked the way he was approaching it without the dogma and without, well, you need to do X, Y, and Z to be this. I'm not interested in any of that. I'm not interested in following a human, right? You know, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in what's the sub-theme of the story that people have latched onto and different cultures have different versions of. Why does the story get repeated over and over? The flood, why, you know? And it must have something to do with our own psychology. So that's interesting. So he kind of reacquainted me, well, acquainted probably for the first time, with an interest in that type of thinking, religious thinking. And it's actually inspired me to go into my own background. So if you're not familiar, so The first monotheistic religion in the world was called Zoroastrianism. It's still around today. It was basically the official religion of the Persian Empire before the Arab Muslim conquest of Persia.
Yeah, you mentioned it. You mentioned it in an email. So I watched this little. It was a 7-minute overview of how do you pronounce it? Zoroastrianism.
That's it. Yeah, Zoroastrianism. Yeah. So I spoke about it once with Jordan. As soon as I started talking about it, his eyes kind of lit up. And then I went back to I went to the index of maps of meaning, and he's written about it a little bit. And you realize in doing a bit more research on it, you can't, Zoroastrianism has been so influential in all the Abrahamic religions. I mean, the idea of the Messiah was originally a Zoroastrian idea. The idea of, one God was a Zoroastrian idea. And it's so ancient. This is 1500 BC. And I've been interested to kind of go into that and to research it and see how it could inspire new stories. I'm really into sci-fi, and I've been doing writing on little short films I want to do. And I want to use some of the things that are there and be inspired by that. And it's because of Jordan. It's funny, this guy from Alberta, from some small town, and we're filming him talking about the Bible has inspired me to go deeper into my own roots. So I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I saw you mentioned in the email that you thought Jordan was a Zoroastrian without realizing it yet.
Yeah. Because a lot of Zoroastrian, as soon as you have a monotheistic way of thinking, you naturally have a good and a bad, like the light. So a main staple in Zoroastrian thought is fire, the divine light. And that's seen as illumination. It's seen as its actual fire. And then the other side of that is darkness. So for Persian New Year, which is the first day of spring, what we do is we light fires and we jump over them. And it's a way to kind of bring light to the dark. It's a way to kind of ring in the new year, out with the old and with the new. And the way Jordan talks a lot about, this is probably, I think, a criticism I would have of him, though, because I actually don't think that this can be that useful, is that he can talk about things a lot in binaries of good and evil, like a Manichaean. So Manichaeanism started by this Iranian guy, 100 AD, Mani, who spoke a lot about that. This is an offshoot of Zoroastrianism, where you got the good and the good and evil kind of thinking, And then you see it trickle down to Star Wars and it's some of the more archetypical stories that we have. And Jordan has that flair to him where he talks about things in binaries a lot. It's a way to tell good stories. It's a way to simplify something to get a meta theme across. Yeah, when he's feeling better, when he's up and about, he's still... Michaela is supposed to do, an update this week on where he's at. But hopefully when I see him next time, I'd like to talk about that with him.
Yeah, I didn't know all of the health issues that he was having too before the film, how he has to keep to a certain diet and just the stresses that he was dealing with behind the scenes. That was, I feel useful too to see as someone who, may not be familiar with Jordan Peterson or has a certain view of him. He has to worry about what he eats and he has to deal with health problems just like everyone else. And I'm sure it's super stressful what he's going through.
Yeah, the worst of it came about after the film was pretty much over because his wife, Tammy, was diagnosed with cancer. When was this? It was
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was late winter. It was spring, late winter. And it was a very rare form of cancer, like 20 people get it. It was really, really scary. She had texted me. She sent me a message on Facebook, here's my new number, call me. And I'm okay, when you get a message that, it can't be good. And then put her on speaker and Jordan was there, Patricia was next to me. And they told us how, they had... And then I get something to do with it, had something to do with the liver, but then they took the part of the liver out, but then it was in the lymph nodes or some medical talk I can't quite comprehend, but I knew it was bad. Anyway, so it was very stressful. Tammy had to be at the hospital in and out of operations and to kind of deal with that, he was taking anti-anxiety medication that I guess just interacted with him in a bad way. There's actually a video of them talking about it on Michaela's YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. So she would probably explain it better than me. But in September, Tammy did an operation in Philadelphia that went super well. And she's totally in the clear. So thank God. But now Jordan, yeah, he's been in rehab and dealing with the kind of aftermath of these medications that I guess went sour. I don't know exactly, but I hope we can get an update soon.
I'm glad his wife is okay, and I wish Jordan the best as well. So the last thing that I wanted to end on, and I'm sure we could keep going for another 3 hours if we wanted to. This has been a fun conversation, but for you, what has been the key to working with your wife and not wanting to kill each other? Because my parents actually worked together for 30 years. They actually still do work together. And so I saw a lot of behind the scenes stuff from work that kind of carried over into the household. And I love my parents. I'm grateful for everything they did. The working relationship though just kind of made me second guess if I would ever want to work with my partner. So I was wondering for you, how have you kind of navigated that?
Yeah, people have asked me that. May I ask what your parents did for work?
Yeah, they started as both speech pathologists and now they run a therapy company where they hire other speech and occupational therapists and physical therapists to work for them. So they're kind of overseeing it now.
Right. So John Kay, the Canadian editor of Colette, he interviewed us last week for Colette. And he was talking about, he asked this very similar question. And what I said to him was basically, well, first of all, she and I have a really good relationship. We're different enough that we complement each other well. Like we both aren't wearing director hats, fighting with each other about our ideas. Like for this Peterson film, like this was Patricia's baby. Like she's the one that started it. She's the director. She wrote most of it. I did some of the shoots. She did most of the shoots. I helped a lot more with promotion and getting the tour and looking at cuts and offering feedback. But in the end, it was her call. I think that what you need is some sort of unsaid kind of boundary where one person has the final say, but you understand each other's strengths and weaknesses. Like Patricia's really good at editing and kind of thinking about different ideas at the same time and thinking about, okay, we do this for a bit, then we jump to this scene and then we loop back over here. I think more conceptually of kind of like what's the main feeling people are getting. And I think that benefits the project. So it's about understanding your strengths and weaknesses. But honestly, and it's been a really good experience, and we both really love making art. You know, like I've done other kind of art projects, like theater or kind of techie works, and Patricia's helped me out with those. And now I'm working on my first directorial debut of a short film, a documentary that Patricia's editing actually right now. So it's been good so far, and I don't think it's for everybody. There are some relationships there that, you know, they like to compartmentalize, like this is for work and this is for play and this is for chill out time. And I just don't have I don't think we have the kind of jobs where we would do them 24/7. Like it's not, we work for ourselves. So we have that kind of freedom. So it's been pretty chill and we're pretty grateful, but I totally get how for most people that's not the case. I would probably say that's something to do with maybe the work that they're doing. The thing about making artwork is that it doesn't feel like work at all. It's just like it's being creative and sorting out conceptual problems and then trying your best to sell it to suits, which Patricia doesn't like to do that, actually. I like to do that more. And she likes to stay in a, you know, introverted headspace and do the editing. So it's about kind of like complementing each other the right way, I guess.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Auxoro. If you haven't already, please hit us with a 5-star rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. This helps us appear higher in searches, which means more people will find out about Auxoro. Other ways to help get the word out is telling a friend, tagging us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, writing a blog post, or supporting us with a donation on Patreon. We are a completely independent platform, and we're grateful for every listener who supports this podcast. Thanks for coming along for the ride, and I'll see you guys next time.